Welcome back to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. There's a beautiful new film that shows how God glorifies himself in his creation in the seas. The DVD is called Living Waters, and one of the leading scientists commentating on that video is Dr. Paul Nelson of Biola University. Living Waters is produced by Illustra Media. They do great work. I forgot some of the other videos, but even just looking at the different titles, I remember, oh yeah, I saw that one. Oh yeah, I saw that one. IllustraMedia.com. So let's welcome our guest, Dr. Paul Nelson. Dr. Nelson, great to have you on Vocal Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So now you are listed as one of the associate producers of this film. How did this film come about?
Illustra Media for several years has been developing a series they call The Design of Life.
Mm.
And the two previous films in the series were titled Metamorphosis and Flight, The Genius of Birds. So the first one looked at butterfly development and the second at bird flight. This is the third film in the series dealing with intelligent design in ocean creatures. So the movie looks at whales and dolphins, sea turtles, and salmon migration. And I was thrilled to be involved in the project. I didn't realize just how amazing whales and dolphins were until I worked on the movie.
Hmm. And this was filmed in Canada, Bermuda, Polynesia, Mexico, and the United States. Now, one of the statements you made in the film is living things, and obviously the context here was those of the ocean, living
right.
things are not random assemblages. You want to comment on your own comment?
Sure. When we look at organisms, and this is true even of the smallest bacterial cell all the way up to a blue whale, what we see, I believe, is clear evidence of intelligence in action. In other words, the kinds of systems that you'd find in a dolphin, such as its echolocation, the system the dolphins use to locate their prey underwater, involve multiple components, all of which are necessary for function, and none of which by itself yields the function in question. So for dolphin echolocation, you've got a system that produces the sound, another system that focuses it, transmits it out into the water, and then there's another system that receives the echoes as they come back, and then those echoes are processed in the brain. Dolphins literally see with sound. That is, they can form mental images of objects using sound in a way that we really can't even understand. We don't do that. So when I say that they're not random assemblages, what I mean is that randomness as a kind of cause could never produce what we see. And the fact is we know this from the things that we make. Smartphones, laptops, airplanes, automobiles, nuclear power plants, you name it. We don't assign those projects to random causes. We pay people, engineers, a great deal of money to get them right using their creative intelligence.
Does natural selection, in a sense, by definition, mean that something is randomly assembled?
Well, there's a selection is a three-step process, and the first step, and really to my mind the key step, is the production of variation, the production of different forms of, let's say, a protein or different types of a bone. And then the second step is, do those differences make a difference to the reproductive output of that particular organism? The problem with natural selection as a cause is that first step, because Darwinians insist on that being random. In other words, the variations, the mutations that occur without respect to their possible outcome. They're just really mistakes in the genetic material.
Like mutations.
Exactly, like mutations. Now, you can do that. You can insist on randomness at that first step as your sort of raw materials or your fuel for the evolutionary process. But if you insist on randomness, then you have to pay the price of randomness. And one of the things we show in the film is for the changes that are required to build a whale, we use a metaphor of a slot machine in Vegas. No one, listening to me, no one in the world can make a living playing slot machines because they're designed to take your money using randomness, right? You sit down with $1,000, you play that slot machine long enough, the casino will have all of your money and you will have none. there's a price to pay for randomness. And that's true in casinos, and that's true in biology.
Well, wait a minute. As far as the casinos are concerned, I mean, there are people who sometimes win.
If they
never win, those casinos would close down because people would realize, hey, I'm never going to win, so I'm not going there.
Right, but that's not the overall trend. No casino gives away...
The house always wins.
Right, the house always wins. No casino gives away more money than they take in. The fact is, mathematically, it's a law. If you sit down at a slot machine, even one with a 95% yield, and you start with $1,000, the way the machine works is it will take all your money. And winning is an illusion, because if you do get a payout and you stay at that machine and keep playing, mm-hmm. eventually the machine's going to have all your money. It's mathematically certain to happen. The only place you can win in a casino is where you can use your intelligence at a game like blackjack. And when casinos find out that you're good at blackjack, they find ways to get you out the door. Because they do. They don't like genuine winners. And genuine winners in games of chance are using their intelligence to defeat the game.
That's a good point. It reminds me of an old line from a W.C. Fields movie where he's sitting down to play cards and his partner or his opponent says, is this a game of chance? Not the way I play it. No, not the way I play it. Okay,
I could just hear him say that.
All right, so as far as the whales example that you were talking about, one of the points that was made was that maybe in 9 million years, two changes within mutations could be caused, but that wasn't enough time. I forgot. Break it down for us, though.
I'll explain it for you. A pair of scientists at Cornell looked at the problem of how long would it take in a mammalian population to get two coordinated mutations.
Two coordinated mutations.
Two coordinated
Define
mutations.
That.
Well, that's two mutations that affect the same system. In other words, they're not just falling any place at all in the genome. They're affecting the same particular functional system in an organism. So, let's say transforming a leg into a fin.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. All right, now the challenge is to get those mutations happening in space and time in a way that they actually are coordinated. So they ran the numbers and they said it would take in the mammalian population 100 million years to get two coordinated mutations. The problem is, for whale evolution, there's only 9 million years available. If you look at the fossil record using standard geology, standard dating, from a fully terrestrial form like a wolf to a fully aquatic form like a bona fide whale, it's a 9 million year interval. That means that you're going to be waiting a long time and your time will run out because you're waiting for two coordinated mutations 100 million years. You've only got 9 million. And the number of changes it would take to transform a terrestrial mammal into an aquatic mammal is in the thousands, easily in the thousands. Everything has to be changed to live in saltwater 24/7, 365.
Plus, there's not only the factor of the time and, of course, the randomness of these changes, but then there's also the idea of that these things all work together all at once, and so, therefore, how could these changes have happened unless it all happened all at once, if that makes
That's
sense?
That's right. If you or I, let's take an example, if you or I were pushed off a boat in an Arctic zone wearing just our normal clothing, we would last about 20 minutes. We cannot retain our body heat. The thermodynamics would overwhelm us. We'd be dead very shortly. Whales and dolphins don't have that problem because of their insulating blubber layer. But you start at one end of a dolphin or a whale and work your way to the other. Everything has to be changed. If we ingested the amount of salt water that they do, it would kill us. So their kidneys have to be changed to handle all that salt water. The female dolphin actually injects milk into the mouth of the baby. There are special muscles in her mammary gland that allow her to do that because of the water pressure, right?
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, one thing we feature in the film that I think is really incredible is if you look at the rear end of a male whale or dolphin, its testes are entirely within its body cavity. Now, every man listening to me knows that his testes in normal circumstances, are not within his body cavity. That's why we don't like to be kicked between the legs. There's a reason for that. To form sperm in a mammal, the testes have to be lower than core body temperature. So what's the problem for whales and dolphins? They've got to refrigerate those organs, and they do that using a countercurrent heat exchange system to circulate cold blood up against the arterial blood that supplies those organs to bring the temperature down to the point where the sperm production can happen normally. So I tell you what happened to me during the production of this film. I fell in love with the incredible design of whales and dolphins. And I'll tell you honestly, from a Christian perspective, I think our creator, our designer, could not have made it more obvious. He did not hide his signature when he made these creatures. In a sense, he's kind of showing off and saying, I'm going to show you that you can't look at these creatures and not see my handiwork in action.
That's very well put. And salmons, they're able to, after they're born, they go a long way, and then they can come back and find the very spot where they were spawned or something like that. Explain
that.
Oh,
that's amazing. When a young fingerling salmon is heading out to the ocean, let's say a river in British Columbia, and there aren't enough resources in that river to sustain it. It's got to get out in the ocean to feed and mature. As it's heading down that river towards salt water, towards the Pacific Ocean, it's imprinting on the odorant molecules that are present in the water that pick out that particular river and distinguish it from every other river in the vicinity. So out it goes. It lives for years in the Pacific, making a huge circuit, going almost halfway to Japan.
What?
Comes around, when it's mature years later, comes back using a geomagnetic compass. So it's responding to the Earth's magnetic field to get back to its natal river. But as it approaches its river mouth, it begins to use the map that it's imprinted, the odorant map, the molecules there in the water. It's literally smelling its way back to, you know, the
its place of birth.
Yeah, its place of birth. It's really incredible. So the movie shows this using computer animations of how these odorant molecules are picked up, sending a signal to the brain, which then compares that to the map that it stored years earlier. Again, it's a case of the designer saying, I'm going to make this so incredible, so obvious, you can't miss my signature here.
Yeah. Well, it's like one of your earlier films. Somebody was even bringing this up in their Bible study earlier this week. They said, look at the example of a butterfly that could fly more than 1,000 miles or whatever, and then go back to the very spot, you know, from which it came, and their brain is, you know, it's like a little dot.
It
is amazing.
The navigation system butterflies is incredible because they have multiple systems. If it's a cloudy day, they can still cover their 50 miles using a different system than the one they normally do when the sun is out and shining.
Wow. Okay, one of the things you say near the end of the film is that science should be, and here's your quote, an open-ended search for the truth. You also said that the assumptions that we begin with in science can yield better results or less results. And it seems as if you're basically saying that if we have an open mind and we look for, you know, what's actually there in God's creation, of course, that's a circular statement on my part, we can yield better results and better knowledge about God's creation.
You know, I would say that even if I weren't a Christian.
Say it your way, not my way.
Yeah,
my way was circular.
For me, the history of biology, the history of biological discovery shows clearly that if you approach living things with the attitude of respect, in other words, I see a system I don't understand, so it's my job to figure out how it works. Not to assume it's just a random assemblage, as we say in the film, but rather assume that there's a functional logic there that will reveal itself on hard work to your analysis. In other words, if you begin with looking at living things with the assumption that they reflect design, that they reflect a purposeful intellect, that's overwhelmingly likely to yield knowledge coming back to you. And in fact, I think the history of biology in particular shows this, when we come at living things with an attitude of respect and admiration and say, I don't know how this works, so now it's my job to figure out how it does work, and assume that there's an underlying logic there, that's going to be fruitful in terms of paying you back on the other end with knowledge and understanding.
You know, that makes so much sense to me. That's like Johannes Kepler as an astronomer saying, you know, we, in those early days of science, they were all Christians, we are thinking God's thoughts after him.
Yes, that puts it beautifully.
Illustra Media, illustramedia.com for more information. Again, the name of the movie is Living Waters. Dr. Nelson, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a treat. Thanks for having me.
Okay, God bless. Bye-bye.